WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year marks the 40th anniversary of Tony Bennett's first record, and Columbia is using the anniversary as an occasion to bring out a new box set of records that span those 40 years. The anniversary will also be celebrated on a July 4th public television special called A Capital Fourth. Some singers lose their touch as they get older, but Bennett is probably a better singer now than he was in the 50s and 60s when he had all of his hits. His voice might have lost some of its power and range, but the years have brought a depth and beauty of phrasing that would be hard to surpass. One turning point in his career was his 1975 album of duets with Bill Evans. With this sensitive jazz pianist behind Bennett, instead of flashy pop arrangements, you could really hear what Bennett could do with a song.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss.
Tony Bennett's first record was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You almost wouldn't recognize his voice. It was a semi-operatic performance with lots of big high notes. I asked him if there were opera records around his house when he was growing up.
There really were, because my brother was a magnificent prodigy. He was a very wonderful opera singer. They called him the Little Caruso. He was 13 and sang solo spots in the Metropolitan Opera. And did radio shows in those days. That was the highest ratings. The shows were big. And he was always a guest artist on very big radio shows. And we all loved opera in my home. And it was during the Depression. And, you know, we'd buy these Caruso records and Gigli, you know, and all these magnificent singers, Richard Tucker, and enjoy the way they sang.
So if your brother was the Little Caruso, what were you?
Well, I was the comedian because I had to compete somehow for all that attention. And I imitated Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor and did imitations of them. And it used to break my relatives up every Sunday. They'd make a circle around my sister, my brother, and myself, and we would entertain them. And we couldn't wait for that Sunday. There was so much fun and so much love was given to us and encouragement.
Now, your father died when you were 9. How did your mother raise the money, earn the money to bring up the children?
Well, she was an amazing lady because she was a seamstress, and she worked so hard and raised 3 children. My older sister helped her so much and raised 2 boys and was, you know, we just were very close and very... Well, it was just the most beautiful home life that you could ever dream of. And it was different. It was sad not to have a father and very confusing. But it's funny. It just shows you when people love one another how many things really work out.
How old were you when you had to go out and work for a living?
I was about 15 when I first started. I started out as a singing waiter in the Pheasant Tavern in Astoria, which is now Ricardo's.
So you had to sing in between serving or sing while you were serving?
Well, yeah, both. It was fun. It was almost chaplain-esque, you know, because I had 2 Irish waiters, and they were great, jolly type guys and always wanted to encourage me. And I'd get a request to sing I'll Get By or a song like that, and I'd run into the kitchen to get... I know if I sang it, I'd get an extra tip, so they'd teach it to me just right on the spot, and I'd come out singing it. And I used to love doing that. You know, it was just so much fun every weekend when I sang there.
Were you still thinking of yourself as the clown when you were performing then?
No, I just enjoyed it. I found out that I've been very fortunate, even before I was known to internationally. I always had luck with audiences. Somehow or other, I always had a gift of communicating, and I got a very nice reaction and encouragement from the audience. So it was always, a positive thing for me to carry on. And I had all kinds of jobs, though. I took all kinds of jobs. I was a runner before computers for the Associated Press, and I'd help the newspapermen get their stories out on the street. And then I was a grocery clerk and an elevator operator, but I really wasn't any good at anything, except I used to have just this craving that I had to become a singer.
Were there any singers in your family? Professional singers?
Well, my brother was a very famous as a young boy. Then he kind of got psyched out by the relatives saying his voice changed at that age, at 15 or 16, and got discouraged about it, unfortunately. But my father, I was told, was a magnificent singer in Italy, that he used to stand on his town in Calabria was in a valley, and he used to sing at the top of the mountain, and the whole town would hear him, and they loved the way he sang. The legend goes.
Did you ever think when you started singing that pop wasn't as important or as serious as opera was?
I made believe it was opera was for snobs, but I just adored it. I still do to this day. I mean, I'm thrilled when I hear a great voice like Pavarotti. I mean, I just know exactly what he's doing, and I have a good ear for hearing good opera, and I know right away if someone is singing well or not in opera, and that's the real thing. I mean, those are the real singers in the world, and I adore them. But I always made believe that the entertainment, I put a lot of wit in it, actually, and with what I did, and I just used to just love to sing. I remember very clearly when I was a singing waiter that I said, if nothing ever happens to me, I'd be happy the rest of my life just doing this.
Tony Bennett is my guest, and the 40th anniversary of his first recording will be celebrated on a public television program called A Capital Fourth, to be broadcast, of course, on July 4th. And also, there's a new Columbia box set called 40 Years, The Artistry of Tony Bennett. That's a compilation of records that spans his entire 40-year recording career. You had an uncle, I think, who was in vaudeville. Did your uncle's stories make you want to go into show business? Did it seem like fun to you?
Well, you know, he was a very wise psychologist, as far as I'm concerned, because his name was Dick Gordon, and Dick Sorace, but his stage name was Dick Gordon. And he was really my father, and I didn't know it. I mean, he would just say, after supper, why don't you come and meet me under the lamppost on the street corner? And he would just hang out and talk to me and tell me these legends. And what an influence he was, because he kind of gave me all the rules and what kind of person I should be if I go into show business. And he warned me that, he said, I don't think you're ever going to make it because you have a rasp in your voice. He said, and if you're a singer, you're not going to make it if you sing. And I don't know, he just gave me a fine tuning as to what attitude I should have when I perform and how careful I really have to be about everything.
Well, how did telling you had a rasp in your voice and therefore you'd never make it as a singer help you?
Well, John Barrymore once said, the harder the slap, the greater the artist.
Were you self-conscious about this thing that your uncle had pointed out to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I taught how to... Louis Belson, the great drummer, you know, Pearl Bailey's husband, the late Pearl Bailey, he kind of taught me how to breathe, and so that when I sing, the rasp is not heard at all. And it's just a matter of breathing before you before a phrase that you sing, you see.
Now, you were in the military in World War II.
I was in the infantry, yes.
Did you sing with a band during that?
After the war, I joined. There was a fantastic story, about Major Lutkoff, who kind of saved me, because I a racial prejudice situation jumped off, and it was terrible in my life, and it just changed my life, completely, and taught me how to behave to my fellow man, because I went to school with a gentleman called Frank Smith, and he was a wonderful friend, black musician, and he and I used to have so much fun together in New York City, and we had a vocal group at the High School of Industrial Art, where I was studying art, and when I was allowed one guest for Thanksgiving at the Truman Hotel in Mannheim, Germany, after the war was over, and I went to his Baptist church and went to Mass with him, and we had a pleasant time, and I said, "You're allowed to be my guest. Come and have Thanksgiving dinner with me." Well, there was a Southern bigot who was a lieutenant, and he, when I came up out of the restaurant, we were having fun, he came and called me Benedetto. He said, "Come over here," and he took a razor blade and slashed my corporal things off my arm and spit on it and threw it on the floor and sent me to graves registration, where you dig up bodies, and it was horrible. And Major Letkoff saved me. He heard about the incident and took me away from there right away and made me librarian for a wonderful orchestra that was conducted by Lynn Arison, the warrant officer, and made me the librarian and singer for this beautiful American Forces Network Orchestra.
So as punishment, you were supposed to find the wounded and the dead and bury the dead?
Yes.
How long did you have to do that?
For 2.5 weeks. It was horrible. You know, it's just a horrible thing in my life. And I've never gotten over it. And man's inhumanity, man, is very important to me personally.
How do you think you were changed by that experience?
Well, it definitely made me anti-war.
Let's take a short break, and then I'd like to talk with you some more about your singing and about your career. And my guest is Tony Bennett. And this is the 40th anniversary of his recording career, and that's being celebrated in two ways. There's a program called A Capital Fourth on public television on the night of July 4th, and Tony Bennett will be performing as part of that program. And then there's also a new box set on Columbia Records called 40 Years, The Artistry of Tony Bennett. It's a compilation of tracks that span his recording career. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Tony Bennett is my guest. How did you get from the military into performing after the war was over?
Well, I took many auditions because that wonderful experience of being a librarian with wonderful musicians that all became quite famous, by the way, later on.
What kind of auditions were you going up for? With bands?
Oh, anything. Broadway shows, any job, any kind of job I could possibly get.
And what kind of jobs were you actually getting?
I didn't get any jobs. I was always turned down, one audition after another. You know, a lot of times I thought I did rather well, but it always proved to me that really it's not until you're endorsed by your own peers that things start happening for you.
When you started recording, what was promotion like then? After you had a record out, what were you expected to do to promote the record?
Well, in those days, I started out with a good friend, Rosemary Clooney, and we used to go from town to town, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and get to meet the distributors and the salesmen and the record shops, and we'd go to record shops and sign autographs, and I was the Michael Jackson of my day. You know, we used to have all these teenagers running after me and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Did you have to run to protect
for my
yourself
life.
Ever yet?
Yeah, that was something. There were so many funny incidents.
Tell me one of them.
One day there was this very stern high school principal in a Brooklyn park there, and there were thousands of girls, and she said, "Now, if you girls don't stay quiet and behave, we're not going to have Mr. Bennett sing for you." And as soon as she said that, they rebelled and broke the barriers. All of a sudden, I had to start running, and it was like a Peter Sellers movie. They were coming at me from all directions. They finally got me in one of those little stone houses, and I was trapped like a rat.
What'd they do to you?
Well, they finally pulled everybody away from me. So it was strange.
So you were intact when you were rescued?
Yeah, I was intact.
No, a lot of the jukeboxes in the 50s when you started recording were, I think, controlled by organized crime.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to deal with that with jukeboxes or getting records played on the radio or anything like that? Or did anyone ever try to put any muscle on you in those early days?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's still going on. It's actually much more severe today. It's actually even deeper. It's very, very organized crime today. Everybody that, you know, with each generation, everybody has to do it bigger and better than their parents.
So what was it like when you were getting started? What impact did organized crime have on you? How did you have to deal with it?
Well, I used to say, they'd say to me, sing Melancholy Baby, and I'd say, well, I don't know that. And they'd say, come to me, my melancholy baby.
So this would be in clubs that would happen?
Yeah, different. Well, not, it wasn't that. It was, you know, everybody had to go through that. In fact, every part of every industry is like that. It's not just the music business. It's every industry.
So, did anyone try to buy a piece of you or anything like that? Did you have to deal with something that?
Oh yeah,
that
but hard? Every artist goes through that. I mean, I read Caruso's life and the same exact thing. I mean, who am I compared to Caruso? I mean, the same thing happened to him. He had to pay, in those days, $250,000 to get out of his contract. And that would have been like $2,500,000 right now.
You are really among the most respected singers today, and certainly of your generation. And I mean, among the things you're respected for is not only the beauty of your voice and the depth of your phrasing, but also your repertoire, your choice of songs, your understanding of what makes a song good. In the 50s and 60s, up until around 1965, you had so many records on the charts. You know, you were recording about 3 albums a year, and a lot of the singles were big hits on the charts. Your last chart hit was in 1965, If I Ruled the World. And after that, rock and roll really took off, you know, monopolized the charts pretty much. what were those years in the latter part of the 60s like for you? Were you trying very hard to land something else on the charts, or had you pretty much given up on that?
I kind of walked away from it. I thought I saw it as a fiasco. It became more and more Madison Avenue programming, you know, just a marketing thing. I've got this wonderful craving. You know, a friend of mine, John Brasher, he's a dancer, and he said to me, God, you paint every day. He said, why don't you stretch out and make it an occupation? So about 35 years ago, I just took him up on that, and I started painting and going toward selling my paintings and all that and having gallery showings. And then it allowed me to become a performer, because I always had deadlines up until then. I had to do, like you say, 3 albums a year and hit singles and all that, and I was really just into the record business, and I just walked away from it. I personally wasn't rejected. I was the one who decided to take a walk, and what happened was very helpful. I learned that things work out for the best, because what happened is I learned how to perform on stage a lot better. Now that I'm recording, my son Danny was responsible for getting a contract where they trust me, and I just hand in the record. And thank God for him, because it's allowed me the freedom to just express myself freely. And I'm very happy with the recording scene in my personal life right now.
You are a singer who, it seems to me, keeps getting deeper into songs the longer you sing.
Right.
That your phrasing just seems to become to have more emotional depth. All the time.
You know why that happened? I think I have the answer to that. It's so funny. When I used to sit around the house and watch my mom, who just made one dress after another, working on a record-breaking time to sew as many dresses as she can, so she'd make a little more money for us to live by. And that every once in a while she would stay very calm and very concentrated on what she was doing. But every once in a while she'd get angered, and she would take a dress and throw it over her shoulder, and she'd say, "Don't have me work on a bad dress." She said, "If you give me a good dress, I don't mind doing this." She said, "But don't have me ever work on a bad dress, on a cheap dress." And that's why I've just decided never to compromise. I think that's what it came from. I saw that, you know, she was able to sustain because she stayed with good quality. And I asked Sinatra one time, I said, why do you think that we've sustained so long through the years? He said, that's because we stayed with good songs. So I think when you do something of quality, somehow or other, you may not be on top of the charts, but you're always respected and you always have a place in society by doing something that's made very well.
How do you think getting older is changing your voice? And if your voice is changing, how do you think that's changing how you approach a song and how you phrase the lyrics?
Yeah, well, Bobby Hackett taught me to work on bel canto scales every day, and so I've been able to obtain four or five more notes on the bottom of my register. So now I'm a baritone tenor, and I take good care of my voice and myself.
How do you work through a song when you decided to do a new one? Do you have your music director at the piano, and do you work it through with him first?
Well, I try to save him a lot of time, so when I first hear a song, I'll have him put it on tape for me, a little cassette, and then I just learn it that way so that we don't have to go over and over it in the studio. And then when I learn it, then I start doing it in front of an audience and get an audience reaction. Let's see how the audience likes it. And then if they like it and I like it, and I think, I always say to myself, if this is going to become a hit, will I be able to enjoy this song by singing it every night? And that's the test I give it. It's a tough test, but it has to have a very musical structure to it, so that if I have to sing a song every night, it's something that I won't ever mind doing.
I guess some singers are really haunted by their hits. They never really like the song, and now they're forced to sing it one way or another every time they perform.
Right, and that's incorrect. You know, it shouldn't. That's when you pick an inferior song. If you have a good song, you don't mind doing it every night.
Tony Bennett's 40th anniversary in the music business is being celebrated with the release of a new box set of his records. And on the 4th of July, PBS will broadcast a live concert saluting Bennett called A Capital Fourth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.